Committee to order. Let the record reflect, the time is 1:03. Today is Wednesday, February 18th, 2009, and we have Representative Seaton Wilson, co-chair, Craig Johnson, and myself, Representative Newman, present. So we do have a... And Kawasaki's floating around here somewhere. So we do have a quorum. On the agenda today is an overview by Bryce Wrigley on barley fuels. Kind of an interesting thing. I've already looked at this a little bit. You know, we look at Alaska's energy futures and what we can do to develop ag. I think it's a good thing. Followed by the first hearing on House Bill 12, that would create a Alaska Council on Invasive Species. We're gonna get an introduction to that and hear some people who are talking about it. We're gonna hold it and let the committee chew on it a little bit. It's quite a bit. It's a large packet, so I want to make sure you got the ability to look at it. We were scheduled to hear HCR 6, but that's still in fisheries, so we're gonna postpone that, but we're gonna get to it as soon as we can. So let's welcome Bryce Wrigley to our committee. Bryce is here to talk again about barley. He is also the president of the Alaska Farm Bureau. So Bryce, please state your name for the record. We also have been joined by Representative Tuck.
My name is Bryce Wrigley. I represent the Alaska Farm Bureau. I also am a barley farmer in Delta. Certainly like to... Oh, go ahead.
Just one more thing for the committee. Bryce, would you rather have questions wait to the end or just take them as we go along?
Let's have them at the end, if you don't mind, Chairman. Okay. I think that some of those questions will be answered in the course of the presentation.
Thank you. Thank you.
First of all, I appreciate the opportunity to address the committee. The idea of burning grain for fuel is relatively new in the United States. It's been done for years in Europe. Resource scarcity over there has resulted over the course of time in development of a number of alternative fuel sources, which we are just beginning to explore now. Barley is a commodity that can be easily grown in Alaska. Developing its use as a fuel is a smart thing to do for us at this time. A bushel of barley has the equivalent BTU output as 2.8 gallons of fuel oil. The most expensive packaging at barley at the current price is $5.52 a bushel. The equivalent BTU output, again, of 2.8 gallons of fuel oil at the price that I pay in Delta is $8.29. Converting it to a price per million BTUs, a bushel of barley has 393,600 BTUs per bushel. A gallon of fuel oil has 142,393 BTUs per gallon. Again, the price is 85% is used as a efficiency rating on the furnaces, on both furnaces. It's a reasonable efficiency rating for most home heating appliances. Using this as a basis, we see that heating with fuel oil is about 50% more than heating with barley. To bring that home to a monthly budget, in your home, if you had a 1,500 square foot home that took 100 gallons to heat, it would cost you, at my prices, about $300 a month. But heating with barley at 40 pounds a day, you'll use 6/10 of a ton at a cost of $138. Barley is probably the most renewable resource that we can grow in Alaska for fuel. It has a harvest cycle of 1 year, a carbon cycle of 1 year. Wood, which is the most common form of alternative heat, actually has a carbon cycle in interior forests of 100 years. In other words, once you harvested it for firewood, you wouldn't be able to harvest it again for 100 years. It has much lower particulate levels, barley does, than burning wood. The outdoor wood-burning furnaces that people rush to buy and set up in their neighborhoods and yards, with the high price we had last year, have resulted in a number of lawsuits and issues with some of the cities that were fighting the EPA particulate levels that came in higher than normal when the inversion set in. Barley particulate levels are much lower than the wood is. It's not a hazardous chemical or hazardous material, and so it can be shipped to villages as a commodity, making it safer and to ship and store to remote areas. One of the big advantages is that barley, being an agri seed, anything that is purchased from an agricultural product, it generally turns out, the agri seeds turn over many times in the community, up to seven times, as is compared with oil, which may turn over once or twice before it finds its way out of the state. And of course, anything we can do in the state to conserve our oil and make it available for a wider market in the nation reduces our dependence on foreign oil. Markets have always been the limiting factor to production in Alaska. And last year, farmers have adjusted, learned to adjust their production to those existing markets. Last year, 4,000 acres of barley were planted in Delta. There's a possibility of, because it's such an easy resource to grow, of planting up to 18,000 acres within a couple of years. Within 3 years, the capability is there to plant 25,000 acres of barley. Again, on condition that an existing market would justify that extra acreage. By the year 2015, 25,000 additional acres would be coming out of Conservation Reserve Program and could potentially be planted to barley as well, for a total of 50,000 acres by the year 2015. Alaskan farmers have been working to create or have been working for years to try and develop a sufficiency in the farm market, and depending on, well, there's 2 million acres a year in the United States that is lost to agriculture, lost for agriculture, to urban encroachment, and that resulting loss can never be reclaimed. Alaska is in a unique position, more than any other state in the union, of being able to put vast resources back into production. Depending on which survey you look at, between 8.9 and 18.5 million acres in Alaska have been determined suitable by climate-wise and soil type-wise for some sort of agriculture production. The original state plan, state agriculture plan, called for 500,000 acres to be in production by the year 1990. Failure to reach that goal was not because the crop could not be raised, rather it was because the markets did not develop as quickly as production did. On a per acre basis, barley will yield about a ton per acre, or 40 bushels per acre. 25,000 acres, therefore, would produce about 1 million bushel. Used for heat, 1 million bushel will heat about 5,000 homes. Canola oil, canola production has also got a tremendous following and is gaining a lot of interest. Last year, there was a farmer in Delta who actually used canola oil to run his equipment, operate his equipment on his farm. So we're that far along. The potential for thousands of acres exists if a processing facility can be built. A small processing plant is already being planned for Delta. Final draft of a feasibility study is about to be completed. And so there's some good possibilities there for canola. We've also found out that we, with a certain variety, we are now able to grow canola that is actually meets the requirements for food grade canola oil. So that would be a commodity we could grow and use in the state for food. Farmers have been working for years to create a sustainable agriculture industry in Alaska, and the original goals of the Ag Project are as valid and as important today as they were 30 years ago. In one generation, Alaskan agriculture has accomplished what took 150 years outside to accomplish. Alaskan farmers are stepping up to the plate to help feed and fuel Alaska. The state can assist us to do this by including barley and other farm bioproducts in the state energy plan. Currently, they are not included in that plan. Another thing that can be done is to make barley eligible under the heating assistance program, so that those who receive that assistance have the option of purchasing barley for fuel where that is more cost effective. State officials might also consider a program to assist villages to make transition from inefficient smoking, polluting furnaces to cleaner burning furnaces that are capable of using barley. And because in order to reach the goal of for 2025 of having 50% renewable fuels in Alaska, funding ought to be targeted. Some funding ought to be targeted to research other biofuels that could be produced on farms, such as straw and grass and canola. And undoubtedly, there are others that will come up as that funding is available. A couple questions that commonly come up when we talk about burning barley is it ethical? Barley is a resource, a renewable resource, which should be used in the manner that's most beneficial. The in-state demand for livestock feed can be met by the production on 3,000 acres a year. It is seldom economically viable to ship any grain outside. We've tried to do that before. The cost of shipping is just too much. Any increase in production, therefore, becomes surplus, and too much surplus discourages future production. Additional markets are needed in order to promote more cultivation, which in turn would stabilize supply for increased livestock production. Asking if burning barley is ethical is like asking if we should burn firewood when there is lumber. Next question that commonly is asked is if there is enough for both processes. Yes, there is a current production and current demand. The goal, however, is to increase the demand for barley by expanding those markets, and at the same time expand production to meet those expanding markets. The more appropriate question is whether there will be enough feed if we do not develop additional markets. It requires a certain level of production in excess of demand to assure livestock owners that their feed needs will be met before they'll invest in a livestock operation. The more markets that can be developed for a commodity, the more security there is for producers to produce that or to increase production of that commodity. I'll be glad to take any questions.
Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I have two questions.
Oh, I'm sorry. I've got one more, if I can just do that. Most of you have probably never been to Delta, and so I have just a short video here. I know that you've heard that production is dead and agriculture is dead. I've seen this before. So for those of you who have never been to Delta, this is the Delta Agriculture Project. There's 120,000 acres here. Most of these farms you're looking at average around 2,700 acres. Production, barley production in the spring begins with fertilization and preparation of the land. After the land is prepared, the grain is seeded either by using no-till method or a grain drill. After seeding has been accomplished, it basically just grows. During the summertime, the grain matures, ripens by mid-August. Usually, the grain is ready to combine. This is grain that we're just ready to combine now. Combining, it's gathered in by combines, which separate the straw from the grain kernels. The straw is a byproduct, which we talked about earlier, could be potentially used for another biofuel, biomass. The grain is augured into trucks and taken to storage. In this form right here, just normal grain, it can be used as feed or it can be used as fuel. It doesn't require any extra processing, doesn't require any extra energy. Once it's ready for fuel, it's ready for fuel. Once it's ready for feeding, it's ready for grain, fuel. Okay. This stove right here is my barley stove. It's got a 60-pound hopper in the back. I burn between 40 and 45 pounds a day. Takes about 30 seconds to fill it up. There's an ash bin underneath the fire pit that collects the burned up ash, and so that's taken out. And we've had that ash analyzed for, you know, composition, chemicals, things like that. Obviously, we knew that there wouldn't be any chemicals, that hazardous chemicals in it, because the barley is used for feed as well. But we did find out that as far as fertilizer, it's got the same basic components as the fertilizer we use in the barley itself, to raise the barley itself. So there's nothing damaging. It could be put on your garden. It could be put on your lawn. It'd be dirty on your lawn, but it could be put on there and watered in. This is the burn box itself, and you saw that turning in there. The most efficient stoves have an auger system that deliver the fuel, but at the same time they have a stirring system that stirs through that burning those burning embers, stirred up, the key to burning barley efficiently is getting enough air into the firebox. And so by stirring that up, then it keeps those clinkers broken up so that they continue to burn until they're just powder. So now I take any questions. I'm sorry, Chairman.
I have Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, this last part answered one of my questions, but it brought up another one.
Okay.
So one was, do you need a special stove? Now, one of those pellet stoves, will this work with that? Will barley work with a pellet stove?
What I use is actually a pellet stove. Some
right.
pellet stoves are also designed to burn grain, primarily corn, because most pellet stoves are manufactured in lower 48. Corn is king. So they'll burn corn. But if they burn corn, most of them will burn barley.
Go ahead.
Okay, and my other question is, if what you the output in the ashes is basically the same as your fertilizer.
They have the same components as the fertilizer we put on. Yes, not in the same ratio.
Okay.
But the same
okay.
components.
Now, is all of the land already cleared? Because obviously, there's going to be more planting, more acres planted than it has been in the past, and. Is the land already cleared, or are you going to have to clear some more land?
Most of that land has already been cleared. Some of it has regrown. I talked to FSA before I came down. There's 72,000 acres that is considered cropland. Part of that, 25,000 acres of that was put into conservation reserve years ago. Actually, some of it has been in there for about 25 years. In an effort to hold the producing potential of that land and prevent trees from growing up on it. Some of the land that was initially cleared in the early 80s and late 70s has regrown into timber again and would have to be re-cleared. But currently right now there is a 72,000 acre land base that could be used. And that's where I got the numbers from for the 2 and 3 year period out. It was from that land that would still be considered farmable. Might take some extra work. Some of it might take some extra work, which is why 2 and 3 years out. But if the market was justified the extra production, then it's available. It's there.
One more.
Go ahead, Representative Wilson. And just for the record, we have been joined by Representative Olson in Gutenberg.
When you compare the ashes from wood to the ashes from this, do you know what the difference is at all? I mean, how much is there when with the finished product?
You mean the quantity of ash or the
yeah.
composition of it?
No, the quantity.
You know, if you're talking about pellets, there's more ash in barley than there is in pellets.
Oh, is there?
Yes. Mm-hmm. As far as firewood, I'm not sure.
Just on that point, Representative Wilson, I purchased a wood pellet stove with our energy rebate because I wanted to check this out personally. And out of a ton of pellets, was about one milk can full of ashes. So there.
But how much is? I mean, I don't know how much a ton is a big. I know it's a lot, but I mean, is it like 4 cords of wood or?
It takes up about 4 foot by 4 foot area.
Oh, okay.
Of
okay.
Pellets.
Gotcha.
Stacked beds.
Okay.
So they're pretty efficient in what they burn.
Wow.
Go ahead, and then Representative Tuck, and then I've got some questions when we're done.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it. You talked about the feed, the fuel, straw, possibly canola, both industrial and food. What about the microbreweries and breweries that we have in the state of Alaska? Are you guys supplying barley for local breweries by any chance?
At this point, we have not been. To my knowledge, there's not a variety of barley that is desirable for breweries. Breweries take a malting barley, which is a 2-row barley. The barley we grow up here is a 6-row barley. However, we did receive a request from just last week from a brewery, I think it was in Fairbanks or in the interior somewhere. We're wondering if we would be able to grow some barley for that. So we'll look into that with the university and see if they've developed or if they're aware of a variety that would be suitable for that. One of the challenges that we have, well, one of the benefits we have of raising barley up here is that we're very high in protein. For feed, that's a great thing. For malting barley, though, that's not a good thing. And we get that extra protein due to the long hours of sunlight that we get. And so that's what we would have to find out, is if there is indeed a variety that would remain low in protein and still with the short season varieties that we would need to grow in the area.
Mr. Speaker.
Go ahead, Representative Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. How many jobs does it employ right now currently as it stands, as with the production you guys are doing?
In the state?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. I wouldn't know. I don't know.
Mr. Speaker. How about in the Delta region?
In the Delta region, wow. I would guess somewhere on the order of 100 to 200. They would not necessarily be full-time jobs. A lot of farming is seasonal, and consequently, a lot of that farming would be temporary jobs, like for students or family, small, or younger family members, things like that. But the expansion of that industry, of course, creates an additional job beyond the market for farm labor. It creates transportation, it creates infrastructure, which it could be substantial. In the lower 48 in America, where farming is still, you know, it's still a very small business anymore. 2 million farmers in the whole, or less than that, in the whole United States of America. And yet the jobs from related to agriculture are tremendous, at 20 million or something like that. So there's a lot of jobs with transportation, processing, packaging, shipping, secondary product. Those kind of jobs would certainly come along, or could certainly come along with this. One of the, if I can, I'm yeah. sorry, I may divert a little bit from your question, but something that I would like to point out, using barley for fuel is just part of the equation. What we're doing here is creating an additional market that will justify the expansion of an industry that will then justify development of a larger livestock industry. Now, in our state, we're suffering right now from being on the very, very tail end of a long transportation chain. And our food security condition or situation here is abysmal. Why don't we use some of the resources we've already got? The state has already invested in this land to clear it, to put in some infrastructure. Let's use those investments and begin to create or to strengthen our food security and our energy security. The resources are there. I mentioned this 8.9 to 18.5 million acre chunk of land that is available or suitable for agriculture production. A big chunk of that lies along those river valleys where the villages are. Those villagers are now looking at coming to the cities because they can't get food up there, can't afford to live up there any longer. They've lost connection with the ground, they've lost connection with their heritage. Let's see what we can't do as a state, as a legislature, as the governor's office, with the agencies involved. These laws are already in place to establish agriculture, to develop agriculture in a rural area, to put people back to work, to give them something to do, to make them connect with the land again. We've got kids up there that look like kids do in Anchorage. They've adopted that lifestyle. They got their jeans down around their pants. They got their hats on backwards. and they look like they stepped out of the mall. And they've lost entirely connection with their heritage, with their roots. And so let's put them back to work. Let's give them something to do. Let's give them a reason to live and a reason to stay there. They don't want to move down here, but they're forced into it. I think that we ought to, as a state, we ought to pull together the resources of the farmers, legislature, the lawmakers, the governor's office, the agencies, as I've said. We ought to pull together and create a dynamo here. And then this is, again, as I said, this is just the beginning. We ship out, I kind of get my soapbox here, I'm sorry about that. We ship out raw materials as if we were a colony. It's time we stop shipping out raw materials and started processing those materials. We got natural gas, let's bring it down here and put the population to work, creating plastics, creating industry, creating jobs and wealth. Let's open Agrium again and start shipping out fertilizer on a worldwide market. I heard somebody say that Agrium was the largest, the plant here in Nikiski was one of the largest in the world, and now it's closed. That in turn, because we had a source of fertilizer here, would assist in lowering the cost of producing food. Now, right now, since Agrium closed, our fertilizer prices doubled last year for urea. If we could bring that plant back online, make it available through that natural gas, that we've got on the slope, and we're planning on shipping it out as a raw product for the lowest price that we could possibly get for it. Let's make secondary and tertiary products. Let's create industry and jobs and wealth and stuff like that. And so that's why I say this is just the beginning of something. This is something that people smarter than me have got to get together and decide, how do we accomplish this? I can see the vision, but I'm not a detail man. So, you guys that know the detail men, you're the ones that need to get together with the rest of us. But all of us need to pull together. The native corporations, they've got that land up there. They've got it, the capability, the production potential along those riverbanks is phenomenal. That's some of the most fertile ground in the state. They could raise their own vegetables. They could raise their own fuel. They could raise their own animals. They wouldn't need to move down to Anchorage or Fairbanks or any other place. So, anyway, sorry about that.
Thanks, Bryce.
Mr. Speaker.
Go ahead.
Thank you very much. I knew he had it in him somewhere. I just had it.
Mr. Chair.
No, and I want to state that, you know, I am totally in favor of agriculture production. I am in favor, you know, you never want to rely on another country, another source for your own food supply. And I do see this as an opportunity of being able to establish our agriculture, be able to sustain agriculture. What NAFTA did to our manufacturing base, I'm concerned that CAFTA is going to do to our agricultural base, and we don't want to rely on another country for our food supply. So I'm just letting you know, put you at ease. I am supportive of agricultural projects and sustaining those. But I do have a few more questions, if I may, Mr. Speaker.
Does anybody else have any other questions here? Representative Seaton. But I just want to comment real quickly, Representative Seaton, on a couple of things that were said here. And it goes back to your question about jobs that are employed. The agriculture industry with the economic multipliers of 7 is one of the largest in the nation when you look at different industries. We looked at some of the fishing industries that were just coming through there. They used 1.5 to 2 somewhere in there, and it's because they affect so many people, and it goes down the line. And you touched a little bit on livestock all the way down to Representative Seaton's, you know, part of the woods. There's a burgeoning industry down there that's really trying to get going. But all the way to our 4-H kids and our products, you know, and trying to get more feed and products into our state, using that in-state. And that's all part of that connection of why that is, that there's large multipliers. Representative Seaton.
Thank you. And, you know, I'm very supportive of the agriculture industry, whether it's peonies or whether it's cattle or barley. And I just want to ask some questions, get them so that they've been addressed on the record. And in barley raised in Delta, do we have any diseases or pests of transport significance where we would be worried? I mean, I presume that we, you know, all this has been dealt with before, but moving barley from Delta around to different other farm service parts of the state, have we got any diseases or pests that are identified as a significant problem in that transport?
No, we don't have any diseases with respect to barley. Incidentally, and most of our products that are raised in Alaska are relatively disease-free and pest-free, as opposed to what you would raise in the lower 48. One of those conditions we talked about last year is the fact that we've been isolated for so many years, they just haven't had an opportunity. Part of it is also our climate, which is not conducive to some of these invasives. However, we do have in Delta and around the state, we do have some invasive weeds. And in the course of combining barley and storing and transporting it, there's a certain potential that some of those seeds are going to be mixed in with the barley as well. But most of that gets blown out. Most of it's a different size, so it gets sorted in the course of thrashing. However, the same weeds that we've got in Delta are also present around the state. The soil and water conservation districts around the state work very hard to try and identify those resources or those weed problems, and then to try and correct them on private land. Currently, we're not authorized or able to do any weed control measures really on public land. Most of those weeds are found on long right-of-way system because that's where the transfer of things take place. So there's some work to do there, but as far as diseases in Delta or pests in Delta that are not present somewhere else, no, there are not. Not in the state.
And I've seen.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And following up on that, is there, you know, the seed potato kind of problem of importing, are we, will the seed be, the, to germinate, will that always be imported, or is that part of the crop that then is, you know, replanted the following years, or is it always imported?
Most of our seed potatoes, in fact, maybe all of it.
I'm in on barley. I just meant that we didn't have that seed potato problem where we were importing a, from the lower 48. Are we?
And actually, I think most of the potatoes are actually developed here. They're grown from mini tubers or whatever, and they're developed here. But with respect to barley, we do bring in varieties from outside, primarily because we don't have the capacity of developing new seed here. We don't have a plant breeder in the university system. We don't have a plant breeder in the ARS system, the Agriculture Research Service, up here at this time. Years ago, we did have. And varieties were developed in Alaska for Alaska. The funding was cut, for federal funding was cut here in about, 15 years ago. They pulled ARS out of Alaska, based them in Sydney, Montana, and then they tried to serve Alaska from down there. Obviously, you can't do that when you've got such a difference in the climate. And so now ARS is back up here, but again, they don't have a seed breeder to create that new variety. So generally, yes, we bring in seed from Canada or look for some in Finland, other latitudes that are similar, and then we try and bring in a seed that will, or barley that will work from that.
And to follow up then, if this project gets going and so we have a stock of barley that's working well for this production, I'm trying to get to the idea of, would an additional thing that happened be some of this barley would be used as seed for the next crop, or
yes,
are, okay, so we wouldn't be having to import all of the seed every year.
Ideally, we would have a seed breeder up here. I mean, there would be enough production to justify a seed breeding position. We'd be developing our own seed again, specific to our climate, to our short seasons, and to our needs. And certainly that's a big possibility, you bet.
And you want me to follow up?
Just go ahead.
More? Okay,
ahead.
Thank you.
It's kind of informal. This little thing on this ag here, just go ahead. And we have been joined by Representative Edgman.
And what is the, we talked just a moment about fertilizer, but what's a fertilizer requirement and how big of a input is that going to be if we don't have Agrium and we're having to import urea or whatever fertilizer? And is that calculated into your costs, your current costs?
It is. Yes, it is. The current price at $235 a ton includes the price of fertilizer last year. There'll be some minor adjustments this year as far as fertilizer price, whether that will translate to an increase in the cost of product. I don't see that happening. Stable barley prices in the past have been fairly stable, even with fluctuations in oil and fertilizer prices, unless there was a big swing, which there was last year. With respect to the amount of fertilizer that goes into barley production, we generally use between a 65 and an 80 pounds, that is units per acre, blend of urea, which is the chemical that can be, or the fertilizer that can be produced up here from natural gas. And so that's the largest single component of fertilizer. The fertilizer blend typically in the Delta area is a 65, 40, 20, 10 blend. 65 of nitrogen, 40 of phosphate, 20 of potash, and 10 of sulfur. And so 65 being the nitrogen, the urea, that's the biggest component of that fertilizer cost, or well, of that fertilizer mix. There are some varieties that are more, or some components of the fertilizer blend that are more expensive than urea, but fertilizer, or the urea, is a critical factor on that.
And then, Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you're going to follow up on the current availability of stoves and what their efficiencies are and costs. And
well, I can kind of let you know on that. Their industry is selling these stoves as fast as they can make them. On the eastern coast, the Hartley stove that he's showing, I checked on those. They went from an 8-hour shift to 3/8, 24 hours a day, and they can't build them fast enough. There's a gentleman in Tokyo that's building some and doing some for wood pellets up there. He can't keep up with the demand. And so I think that the nice part about this is, you know, too, and I just want to echo on what he talked about, reducing costs in rural Alaska, Representative Edgman's community, you know, and some of the others. When you transport barley, it's not like transporting fuel. It's not a hazardous product. If it spills on the ground, it grows more barley, you know, or wood chips that it, or wood pellets that just, it's a natural product. And so the ease and the capability to get that out there, and we figured out our cost since we bought one of these. Last year it cost my household over $5,400 to heat my home with fuel. This year we expect it to run about $1,200 to $1,500. So that's what it's done. That's 2,400 square foot house. And so that's what it's done for my heating bill. But when we look at PCE and fuel costs, other things like that, I mean, for an average 1,000 square foot house, $1,000 to heat your house for the year is not a bad deal. And the availability, I think, is going to become more and more because a lot of the industries are expanding on this, whether it's wood pellets or barley, corn cobs, sunflower seeds. These are all different products that are burned in these stoves. Representative Wilson?
How much does do one of those stoves cost?
We purchased the stove and 4,000 pounds of pellets. The pipe is just a 3-inch pipe that goes out the wall, up 5 feet with an elbow on it, in a 1-inch intake. Everything's sitting there. The stove, 4,000 pounds of pellets, cost me $2,300 up and running.
Wouldn't we be better off buying each family one of those than doing some of the things that we're doing?
That's the way I see
it. Makes way too much sense.
Literally, Representative Wilson, that is a question that we need to be looking at in this. Reducing the cost of energy and, again, expanding our agriculture industry in this state, creating jobs. And, you know, the spinoff industries that are part of this, whether it's 4-H or livestock, whatever, you know, reducing everybody here who puts fertilizer on their lawn, their costs, it's the economies of scale that are played into that. And that's the sensibility of this. And it's an Alaska product. You know, we all talk about how we want to support our Alaska farmers. Get your shoulders behind this idea and let's start pushing. Representative Edgman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was late because I was up at a meeting with the HFC folks who are now in front of House Finance. But the subject of somehow making low-cost capital through one of our state loan programs available to individuals or families, whatever it might be, for purposes just like this was a big part of our discussion. And we heard this when we took the Energy Committee up to Nome and Kotzebue. And you know, right now with the Division of Investments, you can get engine efficiency loans for 2% minus prime minus 2%, which is 2% rate, 2% loan for 15 years. And certainly if you were to spend $2,300 to get a stove and whatever else, you know, maybe you wouldn't need to engage in the loan or not. But that's something that I'm planning to pursue to see if there's some kind of vehicle. We heard this last summer, I believe, in the House Finance Committee during our special session about, you know, a lot of these energy solutions are not going to come from government, or they're not going to come top down to these big programs, but they're going to come from bottom up, from the individual consumer. And so just a FYI, I guess, I didn't mean to interject that, but.
Well, it's just some good comments, too. You know, this group did go to Mr. Haggison on the Energy Authority and this new money that's being put forward to that, and we're told we shouldn't eat our energy.
The comment through the chair, the comment was, they didn't think that feed should be used as fuel. Well, I can understand that comment based if you had a shortage of fuel. Well, we don't have, and that's why I explained it's not cost effective to ship this product out. A surplus stays in the state because you can't afford to ship it out. And so if you've got a surplus, why not use it for whatever you need it for? Take care of the livestock market, take care of the fuel market. It's so easy to produce, so easy to expand production. We can do that. We can do both of them.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. On your economics page, we have a bushel of barley equals 2.8 gallons of fuel oil. And then we show a bushel of barley, basically $5.52, 2.8 gallons of fuel, $8.29.
And that's based on Delta's price. That's the price I paid for this one.
Okay, and that's so when we talk about a bushel of barley, that's just a transportation cost from the farm to Delta.
Yeah, that price is 50-pound bags, which is the most expensive packaging for barley, and that is at the farm.
At the farm, okay.
And so what you're, and you may be going here, and based on some of the conversations, I'm sorry for interrupting, but some of the conversations have been going on. In some places, this is a viable alternative. In other places, it may not be. If you happen to be close to a refinery or someplace where fuel is much cheaper than what I'm spending for, and yet you're a long ways away from the barley field, then it might be cheaper to go ahead and heat your home with fuel. But for many people that don't live near a refinery or are paying high costs, and I think of, for example, the bush communities, and where it's got to be shipped up there anyway, or somewhere around in it within a transportation, we charge $20 a ton to ship to Fairbanks. So that's still within that margin that would make it cost effective to heat with barley. But we wouldn't be able to ship to Anchorage or to the Kenai Peninsula for $20 a ton, obviously. So if there's a point when certain areas would either have to open up new production in areas closer to fill that market, or else it would be simply more cost effective to heat with barley or with natural gas or some other method.
I think what you'd see, though, Representative Tuck, is outlets that would go up there and get a semi-load at a time and bring it down, you know, for the efficiencies of the economies of scale. And I think Representative Olson can tell you that just because he lives next to in a community with a refinery doesn't mean he's got any less price of fuel than a lot of us. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Two more quick questions. With the rotation of crops to try to keep the land fertile, how long can you grow barley on an acre of land? Can you always grow barley on an acre of land and still have the nutrient value or whatever value that you're trying to get out of it, or does it have to be rotated with something else?
Rotation is definitely a plus, and that's one of the challenges we have in Alaska is finding a rotational crop. That's one advantage to the possibilities of canola. If we can rotate with canola, we've got a rotational crop that allows us to clean up the ground for barley, turn around the next year, clean it up for broadleaves. And so that's one possibility. But rotating your ground or leaving it idle. Generally in Delta, what we do right now is a barley fallow rotation. And so the ground does rest for a year, and then it goes back into production. It might be in production for a couple of years, and then it rests for a year. There does, at best, if there's a break. If you continue to raise barley year after year after year, generally you'll see a decline in yields, and it takes a period of time to rest and give everything a chance, all the microorganisms a chance to break stuff down and rejuvenate that ground.
Just on quickly on that point, though, when you saw that when they were preparing the field, Representative Tuck, they're just using what they call a spring tooth, which is taking the top 3 inches or so of soil as opposed to deep root type of cultivation where you're using a plow, you're getting 16, 18 inches. You lose a lot of your topsoil that way, so it's a new recommended way of doing it. So when you're looking at topsoil, which is very valuable in the state of Alaska, wind that they do have in Delta, in making sure that they keep what they've got there as they're preparing the tilt of the soil and improving that, that's one of the methods that they're doing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My questions are just because I'm really interested in learning more. The 18,000 acres that we have in Delta in 2 years and in the forecast of 25,000, 50,000, was that also in consideration of any type of crop rotation? Could let them sit for a while. Was that also in consideration with these figures?
No, actually, I didn't take that into consideration. What I was just pointing out was that potential. These increases could be made based on the available acreage at this time. Now, that would be without putting any extra ground into production. As a matter of course, we've got 120,000 acres in Delta alone. The Nanatochaket area has 155,000 acres. In one fell swoop, you could more than double the acreage in production in Alaska by opening that up. And Nanana, the advantage to Nanana is it has a 10-day longer growing season than Delta, which opens up new crop varieties, which we can't grow because of our short season. So there's immense opportunities here. I mean, I'm really serious when I say that nowhere else in the country have we got the opportunity of putting this kind of acreage back into production or drawing 2 million acres a year out of production to build cities on. Once it's built, you know, when you build a city on it, you don't just build it on the topsoil. You take the topsoil off, you go down to gravel, and you build your city. So it's not a matter of taking the city out and putting farms back, and you can't do that. And so we've got that opportunity, we've got that resource still available to us.
Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And you segue into something I was going to talk about, and I have been to Delta many times. The other thing, I mean, it's amazing that the difference, the 10-day additional growing season in Nana versus Delta. I mean, that's kind of an amazing number. And I know, remember the debate went on where the crops, where the barley project was going to be. Some people felt that Delta was a better place because of those 10 days. But the other thing that Nana has is railroad. Mm-hmm. Being on the railroad is a major consideration. But the first crop before you plant barley, and barley has the ability to be more than just a heating crop, is black spruce or willow, because that is a major fuel source also. And there have been proposals in front of this legislature to do biomass in rural Alaska, take a village or a community out nowhere, basically draw a circle around it, and harvest a cycle around it and turn it into wood chips. I mean, we have a phenomenal amount of biomass available to us. Barley is one that we would be producing, but willow is a phenomenal heating product, there's people that have been working on that for a long time as well. The Delta fields are amazing. I've always thought it was quite a project. And I had a university researcher come to me a few years ago, and his whole point was the supply chain is broken, basically, about a crop development, wherever it was in the interior or in Alaska, that there was a link missing in the ability of getting the crop to market, whether it was in-state or out-of-state. Is that still a consideration? Have you talked about that? Or?
We haven't necessarily talked about that, I mean, in terms of this mm-hmm. presentation. Certainly that's part of the infrastructure that could be improved. We have talked, and I assume this committee is probably familiar with the proposed rail extension down to Delta Rail Spur. That would certainly help for the current time. We bring fertilizer on the rail up to Moose Creek, and then we have to truck it down, mm-hmm. and it takes 2 weeks of trucking, constant trucking, to bring that from Moose Creek down to Delta. And of course, you got the same issue when you haul grain back or any other commodity back. You got to truck it, and we don't truck it to Moose Creek. We truck it wherever it needs to go, to Anchorage or to Kenai or to Homer. We truck it wherever it needs to go. We don't go back onto the rail system. There's really not even a loading facility to speak of. There's a sidetrack at Moose Creek, which we have to use our own auger and roll it underneath there and unload it and then haul it home again. And so there's really no facilities for taking care of those things. So obviously there's some infrastructure that could be improved on that, or a rail spur to Delta, which would help immensely. But your comment about Nenana and having a rail right there, that's an ideal situation. You grow the crop, you put it on the rail car at a siding, and you ship it wherever it needs to go.
And Moose Creek is Eielson, just so if you're wondering.
Yeah. Kind of,
yeah. There's some grain silos sitting around somewhere to do what he said. You know, you brought up an interesting point, Representative Gutenberg. You said those used to be black spruce forests. And when you look at these pictures now, you know, when you look at the wildlife habitat in a black spruce forest, you don't have a lot of wildlife there. Now, when you have these barley fields there, you look at the fringe around there, you've got alders, you've got willows. So now you've got a whole new ecosystem for wildlife, and that whole biological system where you got everything from songbirds to partridge, game, you know, game birds, all the ducks, cranes, geese, everything that are landing on these fields, the moose, the bison, all those combined species that are there now that didn't used to be there now. So that helps our fish and wildlife, you know, our game industry, or mm-hmm. so the spin-offs or the offtakes of things like this is just tremendous. Bryce mentioned earlier a little bit about some of the spiritual connection to the land too, and only a farmer bring it to our attention and say, we could just grab them kids and tell them to pull up their britches and straighten up their hats, you know, that would be a good thing. But you can tell this guy's spiritual connection to the land, too. I mean, he's into it. He lives it. It's under his fingernails. And I think that's an important part of what we do here, too, is trying to get that back into Alaska. Do you have any other wrap-up? Anybody any questions? I just happened to notice we got our director for Division of Ag in the back. Francie, would you like to add anything?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Bryce.
Through the chair, I'd like to say that I think that it's...
Come on up. Francie told us today that the mission for the Division of Ag is to promote agriculture in the state. That's their main goal. Name, please.
For the record, I'm Francie Havenmeister, the director of the Division of Agriculture, and thank you for the invitation to address the chair. And I agree with a lot of what Bryce is saying, and we have a good working relationship with the Farm Bureau, and got together and did a long-term plan, which involved them as well. And one issue that was addressed was the lack of infrastructure. It's amazing to me that we have a barley project, but no way to transport it. And as far as the bioproducts, I think, or the biofuels, I think that anything that will cut my heating bill by a fourth or a half or even three-fifths is something that is worth looking into. So I appreciate the conversation that was had today and the discussion on agriculture. I appreciate any input you can have to promote this. We have a lot of farmers who are willing to do things that the majority of us aren't. And I think that's important to recognize.
Thanks, Francie. Any questions for the director, Representative Gutenberg?
Well, you know, people turn to us and say, so my heating bill or whatever, what are you doing about it? And we turn to you and say, what's the division doing about it? I mean, where are you? Is your plan in place? Do you have infrastructure needs? Have you advanced things to the governor's office or otherwise? So where are you at with help with moving this conceptually or in a reality way along?
Through the chair, Representative Gutenberg, we have addressed it in our plan. There is no fiscal note attached. This was the first time, from my understanding, I'm fairly new to my position. I've been in there about 17 months. This was the first time that we had industry buy-in to a plan that we could all come to agree on. And I believe that for us, that's a great way to form the beginning steps on where we want to go. We have not addressed anything with a fiscal note this year. We realize there is a need, but no, we have not done anything to address it.
And if I may, do you think we could get copies of that plan?
Yes, you may.
Thank you.
We worked hard on that one. It was a good one.
Yes.
And just for the commercial fishing guys, too, I just want to remind folks that HCR6, we're not going to be doing that today because that's still in fisheries for any of those comfish guys who are waiting on that. Representative Seaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It seems, Francie, like we are working on the agricultural end and trying to push a supply onto a system that doesn't have the users online. And Mr. Chairman, it seems to me that from the legislative standpoint, you know, what we can do is work on getting through energy rebate use of stoves if we need to get more supplies of stoves into an area, do a demonstration project where we offer to work with one of the villages to replace most of the heating system in the village and getting transportation in not one person trying to buy 50 bags, but, you know, you do a supply to the village. So it seems like that if we want to work on this resource development, we need to work on the other end of it for the utilizing of it. And then I think the department and the industry that's sitting there, the agriculture industry, will step up and supply the necessary product. But it sounds like we need, through the Energy Committee or someplace, we need to talk to our energy czar and figure out what's going on, because it doesn't seem like it seems exactly the I don't know if the co-chair was here when it was said that when this all came forward and was addressed, it was like, well, we don't want to do that because that you can use barley for food and we don't want to have a food stock go to fuel. And so I think that maybe what we need to do is work on the utilization end. And I think I'm sure happy you brought this forward, Mr. Chairman. And I don't know if it's fair to put on the Division of Agriculture the push to do the utilization. I mean, I think we around this table and the legislature have to make that utilization come, and then they can work on the supply. So anyway, I just wanted to put that forward, because I don't think we can ask the Division of Agriculture to go work on manufacture, importation, or utilization of wood stove or barley stoves. I mean, they're in the supply, and if that makes sense to you, Mr. Chairman.
Absolutely, and we're going to be working with this down the lines. Folks from ADA were in the office today, and we kind of discussed them, you know, the availability. If people can afford fuel right now, they can certainly afford this, and so, you know, because it's a lot less.
Tell me again. Tell me about that. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, some people can't afford fuel, I guess. Maybe they can't afford this. We'll state that. Can't you just, Bryce, looking at Representative Edgeman, he's probably thinking, here's how we got all those fuel tanks. They're going to be grain elevators someday, huh? Representative Wilson?
I thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a question, and I'm not sure if it's through Francie or Bryce, but it's the question of the barley farmers themselves, so might be Bryce.
Let's just have Bryce come on up and sit next to Francie, and can ask questions if we need him.
It's a green.
And just for our clerk's benefit, state your name when you speak.
Bryce Wrigley.
Okay. Bryce, for the, I know that the barley project as a whole has really kind of gone downhill over the last few years, and I don't have a clue whether the people are just living there and just hardly making it, or whether some have gone bankrupt. I don't know the situation at all, but are there some farms that are just vacant, or is everybody on a farm and this is just going to be like a lifeline that can really start things up again?
A number of the farms don't have power, and they don't have houses on them. Same token, a lot of the farms do. When the farms were laid out, actually, in the Barley Project, there were also home sites laid out in the area around. A lot of those farmers live in some of those home site areas, so they've got their homes and stuff. While not on the farm, they are in the vicinity.
Oh, okay.
And there are still a number of farms that don't have power. When power is needed, then they'll use electrical generators. Diesel power generators, but for the most part, most farm activities don't require, you know, anything but machinery equipment until you get into like transporting grain, drying grain and things like that. The Farmers Co-op in Delta was established to store fertilizer, store grain, dry grain, take care of some of those issues. But a lot of the farms, larger farms in particular, have storage and facilities available already to dry the grain and store the grain on the farm. So in answer to your question, there are some farms that while they still are owned, there are some that are not in production. And certain activities take place periodically to keep the brush mowed or to keep it reasonably accessible to eventual farming. And those are the acreages that I talked about earlier that would take maybe 2 or 3 years to clean up and put them into production.
Okay, thank you very much.
But large acreages are available, could be planted this year. Well, not this year, because it's already there. Next year.
Say, Bryce, would you mind giving, you're farmers, you probably don't have business cards made up, it's not your highest priority.
But actually, I do.
Good. Well, if we could maybe get them to some of the committee members, so, you know, if you got further questions, stuff. We do have a number of presenters who do want to continue. We've got another piece of legislation we need to look at. So, certainly, Director Havemeister is always available. I've got her cell phone number if you don't need it, so she's always available. Representative Seaton.
I just wanted to ask one more question. I noticed that you had said that that burning the particulates were down much from wood.
Mm-hmm.
We've heard a lot from the Fairbanks area about the high price of fuels and everything else, and then there was some problems of people converting to wood and air quality up there. Are you familiar with, or we have two representatives from the Fairbanks area, which is, you know, a lot closer than Anchorage or Homer. But Is that enough of a problem that puts a damper on barley for fuel in the Fairbanks area?
Because the particulate level is so much lower than the outdoor wood-burning boilers, it wouldn't even show up as a blip, I don't think. When I have my stove going, I don't even see the smoke coming out. And so, I mean, it's that clean. What actually happened in Fairbanks particularly, when the prices went up last year and people started looking for pellet stoves, things like that, they came up short. There weren't enough in the pipeline to buy, and so they, because they wanted to save some money on heating their home, they went and picked up some of these outdoor wood-burning boilers, which are very inefficient. And they put them in, they go outside, they put them there, and then they just smoke all the time. They burn a tremendous amount of wood, and they put out a lot of particulates in the air. And, of course, with the inversions that Fairbanks gets, then that created a real major problem. A lot of those guys that I've talked to would not have bought those furnaces if the barley or if the pellet stoves and barley stoves had been available, but they were not. Same token, some of them went to coal stoves because they couldn't get the barley stoves. That was what was available to help them reduce the cost of their heating. And so they took what was available. And unfortunately, in many cases, it was a second option.
And the barley stoves are available now?
Yes, the barley stoves are available. As the chairman mentioned, Harmon ramped up. Harmon was actually purchased by another company, and coincidentally, it just hit that this tremendous demand with the price of fuel went up, and everybody in the country started looking for an alternative source of heat. And because of that increase in production, then they have included that.
And we do need to remind folks, we need about 45 minutes for the next presenters, too, so we're getting a little short on time. Representative Wilson, did you have a quick question?
Go ahead. No, I don't.
Well, I thought you had a question.
Well, I did, but I forgot.
Go ahead.
I forgot what it was.
Okay. I'll be happy to, if anybody wants to contact me, give me a call. I'll be glad to talk to any of you. I'll be glad to meet with you again. I expect to be down here again in a couple of weeks for Senate side.
And I'd be glad to sell you a membership to the Farm Bureau.
Yes.
And you can stay updated. Okay. Thanks, Bryce. Thanks, Francie.
Thank you.
Okay. Next up is House Bill 12. House Bill 12 would establish the Alaska Council on Invasive Species. Sponsor of the bill is my co-chair, Representative Johnson. I believe his staff, Jeannie, is going to be here to present the bill. She's going to be assisted by Michelle Hebert, who has two separate presentations for us. So go ahead, Jeannie.
Yes, I do have to transfer these two. And the bill, as you've seen it, expanded a bit with some reports behind, and I think you all saw those. It's a large packet, but probably the most important part, or maybe not the most important, but the most telling part is the number four, if you look at the index, was that the Christmas trees that had the bees in them. And I think that's what the title is there. But it was a 747 full of Christmas trees that ended up leaving Oregon. And they were certified by the state of Oregon as clean and were going to Hawaii for school districts and for churches to make some money on them. They were going at a wholesale price. They were going to sell them retail. The 747 landed in Hawaii, probably Honolulu, and they had their inspectors go on the plane. There were queens, there were eggs, there were flying hornets and yellow jackets, some sort of microbe in the soil. So Hawaii said, no, we're not taking this plane. And so the good folks decided to bring that plane to Anchorage. That plane landed. All the trees were taken off. They were put in a warehouse. All the trees were sold for $40 a piece, any height. Of course, they went like that. And so in a weekend or a few extra days more than that, the good deed to help the nonprofits and some churches make a little money, dispersed those trees throughout all over the place. And within week, Cooperative Extension was receiving phone calls. Yeah, we got hornets in the house, and I got yellow jackets flying. And so in that case, it was the point that brought it to the head that we don't have a policy. And the Invasive Species Working Group is the part of that bill that's also in here, and we have a memorandum of agreement in the packet. And that's signed by over 30 agencies here in the state, federal agencies, state, and people working toward dealing with the invasive species. The 2 years that they've been working, they have had departmental people on the working group. We can't get to the point of having the policies made. And so this council, with the five commissioners on it, was brought forward as a first thought to try and bring the state into a policy form that would keep us from becoming like all the other states in the United States. We are very lucky that we are have some isolation here, but things are changing, and that's where I believe Michelle Hebert can go through these PowerPoints with you, and then we'll go from there with any other questions.
Okay, is Michelle online? Jeannie, do you know if Michelle's online?
She's not online. Oh, I'll
go ahead, Jeannie. You can just go ahead with the slide. You're on. Go to Plan B.
I'm looking to call her.
The show must go on, right?
Right.
I think we can probably. We do have some other people who'd like to speak. Maybe if we can try and get Michelle online too while we're waiting on this. Just kind of switch it up.
I can go through here if you want. It kind of is a an overview to what I was saying. These are the signatories on the MOU. A number of people that have been involved have come forward with good ideas. The web page, if you haven't been up there, is very helpful, has a lot of links. It would take it to the point that they would actually come up with a plan, but as I was saying, the main problem is they haven't been able to get to the policy level here in this state. On the national level, the invasive species are estimated to cause over $1 billion a year in environmental and economic damages. Almost half the states in the U.S. have some sort of group addressing all taxa invasive species. These groups vary in their composition, level of state support, structure, and activity level. State-based organizations can react more efficiently and effectively to areas of local concern. The University Cooperative Extension Service was initially funded by the EPA to coordinate the development of an invasive species council. In 2007, it has received funds from Department of Fish and Game, from NOAA, and from the Prince William Sound Advisory Group and the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. Alaska experiences fewer invaders than many of the other states. The goal of the working group is to help preserve the natural environment and economic resources. Alaska is lucky to be at the beginning of what could become very expensive and deleterious effects from the invasive species. Groups have already formed to address plant invaders, marine invasions, and other concerns. The Alaska Invasive Species Working Group aims to coordinate existing efforts and to protect Alaska from invasive species from all taxonomic groups. That meaning not just the weeds, because everybody who looked at this previously was saying, well, didn't we do this last year? And last year we kind of dealt with just the plants. So this is the all taxa, meaning your invertebrates, your birds, your insects, microbes. So the goal is to help preserve Alaska's natural environment and economic resources. The working group's aim was to coordinate existing efforts, protect Alaska from these various taxonomic groups, and increase the effort through coordination. In your packet, you do have a two-page briefing paper, as well as the MOU. It was written for legislators as well as the general public. The outlines of the working group is included in that. A lot of that is in the sponsor statement as well. They have monthly teleconference meetings. Different subjects are worked through. Marine Group, Green Crab, and Tunicat monitoring groups are already in full swing. The listserv goes out on anybody who is involved is sending things to a specific one area, and then that goes out to a tree of emails. So people are getting information as it's happening through a listserv that the university, through Michelle Hebert, is basically making that work. And their website, alaskainvasives.org, is full of information as well as links to many parts. The Marine Subcommittee Monitoring Coordination Teleconferences has have been held for green crab and tunicates. Sampling efforts are on track for this summer in several locations: Valdez, Homer, Sitka, Juneau, Ketchikan, and Gustavus. The Smithsonian Environmental Research Center has been working with both groups, and Alaska DOT has been very helpful in working toward getting the tunicate monitoring at the selected ferry terminals. The green crab poster has been printed, laminated, and is on its way out to the coastal communities. The top 10 list, basically, for the marine people already here is the Atlantic salmon, boring sponge, the dead man's fingers, golden star, rockweed, the violet tunicate. Not yet here, but could be close. I think some of these are actually in the British Columbia area. Atlantic cordgrass, the colonial tunicate, the green crab, and the New Zealand mud snail. There are some photos there of it, and in your handout you should be able to see those. Arctic and red foxes on Alaska Islands, introduced by to 400 islands by fur merchants in the Russian and in the territorial days. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service began eradication on the uninhibited islands in 49, and over 40 of those islands are now fox-free. Removal of the fox allowed the Aleutian cackling goose to increase numbers on fox-free islands and be removed from the endangered species list. Rats, the Norwegian rats, were introduced by shipwrecks and ports since 1780 and ate the bird eggs, basically, and the rat plan and eradication efforts are ongoing. The European green crab, they have handouts that have been going to the communities showing the difference between our green crab and the other crabs that we have here locally. It's not currently here. It's native to Northeast Atlantic, but currently is found as far as northwest as the Vancouver Island, transported by either ballast water or hull fouling. It's a voracious hunter and could compete with the Dungeness crab and other native species. The Atlantic salmon, Fish and Game estimates there are up to 3,000 present in Alaska waters each year. Farmed in British Columbia, escapees have spawned in at least one BC river.
Say, Jeannie?
Yes.
Just to try and make sure we have everybody to get a chance to present, this slideshow is in our packet. If you could maybe just kind of go through and hit the highlights here, and then Michelle is online, so if she has anything to add when you're done, we'll just have her comments. So if you can just kind of hit the high points, I want to make sure everybody gets a chance.
The Atlantic salmon that did get free, I understood that they had sea lice or fish lice. I'm not sure what the term is, but that is something that is out in the oceans and could affect our salmon. The insects, I'm sure you've all seen the birch miner, and if any of you live near a tamarack, the big kill off of the tamaracks that happen, defoliation of them. We have a chronic wasting disease that's up here, found in 14 states, soon to be here, I think. And then the late blight disease that hit the Mat-Su Valley. That is the Irish potato famine. It is here in Alaska. It is a problem. And I think it has been held to the Mat-Su Valley. Opportunities is like what I was saying in the beginning. We need to coordinate these state resources. The policy level is the problem. We can't get to that level. this advisory council should be able to bring these people together and form some sort of state policy. Basically, they feel the House bill would help that in their efforts.
Thanks, Jeannie. Michelle, are you online? Are you out there? Michelle Aber?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, Michelle. Please state your name for the record, and if you've got anything to add to that.
Michelle Aber, and I'm with the Alaska Invasive Species Working Group. The other thing I guess I would add is currently within the United States, there are 17 states that are using councils, invasive species councils, and California's been just recently added to that. And with these invasive species councils, they've been able to really pool resources and get a lot more accomplished and save lots of dollars for their state by pooling resources and having the decision makers come together in a council. And I think that's the beauty of HB 12, is it gets the commissioners sitting down together so that we can make some suggestions on policy changes and some decisions on how we can share resources to make better use of our money and to make things happen more quickly in the state. I think over the last 3 years, the workhorses who are on the working committee have been working really hard and got a lot of things accomplished, and Jeannie did an outstanding job of summarizing those action items and how much has happened and also what some of the threats are. But the committee has put, the working group has put as their top priority the need for this council, because we've been limited in what we can do without those policy decisions. And that's the big key here and the beauty of HB 12. And I think if we look at the other states that are dealing with invasive species and spending millions of dollars, they've found that the council has been able to move them forward more quickly in being able to prevent and manage those that are already within the state.
Thanks, Michelle. Do we have any questions for Michelle from the committee? Representative Wilson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Michelle, what are your intentions? Because we do have, especially in the group that just was before us, the farmers in Alaska, a lot of them have timothy and alfalfa and have planted those crops which aren't native to Alaska, but that's something that they need as food for their animals and whatnot. What are your intentions in those areas?
Well, the real beauty is all the work that has gone up to this point with our Invasive Species Working Group and SNPM, which you may be familiar with, which is the Committee for Noxious and Invasive Species Management. What we have always done from the beginning, and this was initiated by farmers, is bring everyone to the table so that no one's important crops or no one's concerns are not heard. So we are about the seventh or eighth year of getting together as a group to develop strategic planning for invasive plants and for annual meetings. We're in our sixth year of annual meetings together. And because of that, we hear concerns about certain crops or certain plants. And so to this point, the farmers are at the table, they're being heard, and no one is threatening to take any crops away, such as timothy or ryegrass that needs to be planted or brome. And we are not trying to target exotic plants. What we're trying to do is target invasive species that threaten our wild lands. And these are unique, and you've probably heard some of them, like purple loosestrife, which is real big in the Anchorage area. We're not trying to take away crops. We're trying to identify things that are getting into our wetlands or into areas where wildlife can be harmed.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Wilson. Any more questions for Michelle? I think, Jeannie, did you have something to add?
I just wanted to add to that Alaska is a right-to-farm state. If you have a farm, you have the ability to farm, and we are not right to work, but right to farm.
You know, I do want to add something that I should have said.
Michelle?
This whole thing, this whole invasive species movement for the state of Alaska was actually started by farmers out of my office. What happened was the farmers came to me and said, Michelle, we are getting tired of weeds from federal lands blowing into our farms and us having to use extra herbicides to get them out. What are you going to do to help us tell those federal guys they need to control weeds? And so that's how this whole invasive species movement got started, by hearing the concerns of our agricultural community. And I'm representing the invasive species working group to testify, but I'm an agriculture and horticulture agent for the Cooperative Extension, and I've been that in this office for the last 18 years. So that's where my main concern is, and my heart is with agriculture.
Representative Wilson?
I do have one more question, Michelle, and it's just because I have no idea on how Alaska is set up. But for instance, when those Christmas trees came into Alaska, do we have no one at the ports that checks things like this?
We are not adequately staffed. But it also may be that we don't have the regulations to keep that particular insect out of the state of Alaska.
Is there... I'm appalled. I think that should be an automatic part of government, I guess. I don't know. But is there... can we... and I suppose that's building government. Is there any way that we can get that taken care of using private industry, or what are suggestions that you might have?
Well, I think the biggest suggestion is to bring all the players together, and I think that's, if you look at what's been accomplished through SNPM or through even our working group, it's been because we get everyone together. And I think that's the only way we're going to keep things out, because we have so many different land managers doing stuff, and unless we are at the table together talking about what the issues are, we can't help each other out. And that's what happens. If the people from agriculture had been talking to the people from Coast Guard, we would be more likely to catch these things. But maybe the people at Coast Guard look at something and say, what is this, huh? If we're all sitting at the table together and we have a common voice to address issues, we're going to be more likely to be able to develop some early detection and rapid response and preventative measures. And I would much rather see us get everyone to the table talking and develop a process for communicating with each other quickly than waiting till we have a severe problem and then getting out a lot of pesticides and hosing things down. Or worse to me is, if we aren't speaking to each other, then we start pointing fingers and being concerned and being all up in arms when we really all have the same goals.
And I want to try and remind people, too, so we can make sure we get everybody who wants to testify here. But Representative Wilson, I think you should have a good discussion with our director when you get time, because she does have some capital requests. We do have a plant materials center that does look at different seeds that are coming to the state. And making sure we maintain that. She does have an inspector that goes down to Wrangell and looks at logs to make sure that they're clean for export. So they're working on that within a department. So we are doing that at our state agencies. They just need to be funded adequately. So we got the people there. Representative Kawasaki, then Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thanks, Michelle, for being online.
Oh, hi, Scott.
I know that you've been involved with the invasive species work group for a little while, and you mentioned it's been around for 7 or 8 years now.
Yes.
And then also SNPM, who I recently, we learned the acronym last year. If we, if we create another council, don't you think it sort of dilutes the message?
I'm sorry, that it dilutes the message?
If currently, the invasive species working group and SNPM are already working on issues. Wouldn't adding a council seem to be, additive to the whole process? Or is there? I'm wondering if there's an efficiency to be made here without creating another council. I personally don't like task forces. I don't like councils, and I'd like to see things as minimal and efficient as possible.
I think the key is here that the working group that has been trying to accomplish things over the last few years has found that they've been frustrated in that they've been held back by by policy, and they can't seem to make an impact in having policy changed. And so it is the recommendation of SNPM and of the working group that what we do need is decision makers together at the table to and then keep intact. We're still going to have all the workforces. We're still going to have SNPM. We're still going to have the working group. And they're going to be the technical part of the process. But we need decision makers to come once a year and to be able to make recommendations to the legislature. So we have just felt that this is a very needed thing that's been missing, that's not allowed us to move forward as quickly as we need to have a strong preventative program. So it doesn't take away what we're already doing, which is all the workhorses, all these really enthusiastic people, which you'll probably hear a few on today. But this is what we think is the step that's missing in the process.
Thank you, Michelle. And Representative Kawasaki, we will bring that into committee discussion and look at it pretty hard when we come into here. Go ahead.
And then I think you might have answered my question already. So then you see the invasive species work group and SNPM still being very active. This council is not replacing their function.
Actually, this council is more recommendations for policy change and sharing of resources. And then if you look at the bill, there's additional things that say we will use subcommittees and technical groups as needed to accomplish what we need to be accomplished, and I think that's what's going to happen is there's going to be a strong dialogue between SNPM and the Invasive Species Working Group and this council. What's needed, what recommendations are, what frustrations are, how can we make this move more quickly so we can share resources and make policy changes with the expertise we have.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that in the municipality of Anchorage, they're very strict about making sure there's no rats. I think Anchorage is one of the only major ports in the world that is rat-free. I went to go see Ratatouille about last summer or the summer before, I can't remember, and I was babysitting a little girl, and we happened to see a little white mouse after watching Ratatouille along the bike path in the Diamond area. And we made a phone call because that's how serious the municipality is. How is this going to coordinate with other programs? Is that part of the council's mission, is to look and see what's out there already, see how programs being implemented, and they plan on taking that over as a state agency or as a state council, or are they just basically coming up with policies and allowing local municipalities or local boroughs and communities to take charge of it for themselves?
The council isn't going to be controlling any government entity or any city, and they're going to be utilizing probably the working group and SNPM for looking for guidance, because if you look at even the rat issue, the working group, in our working group, we have about 50 people who are very active from many agencies, and we are talking about rats all the time. There's even a website devoted to stopping rats. We have presentations at our annual meeting on rats, and so we've actually, because of the working group, had multi-agency projects to control rats and the Aleutians. Because we're all coming together in meetings, we're identifying which agencies need to get involved, how we can share resources, and doing better jobs at controlling rats. But on the same hand, we're not telling each agency what they need to do. We're just sharing ideas. But when a frustration comes up and says, boy, we really need to share more resources, most of the people on this working committee are just regular biologists or people who aren't decision makers. And so we see the council as an opportunity to share resources with the decision makers.
Thank you, Michelle.
I hope that's clear.
Yeah, and Michelle, could you forward your contact information to my office, and we'll distribute it to the members to make sure that if they have further questions that they can continue on with you. I'll make sure that you get to do it. I guess the data's in our packet.
It's the last pages of your packet.
Last page of our pack, Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you. Thank you, Michelle. Good to hear your voice.
You too, Dave.
You know, you touched on something, and you know, how far down the road we go, whether it's justified or not. I mean, I've been in other states where there are agricultural inspection stations along the way, or try to take some produce out of Hawaii or something like that. You know, and the working group doesn't have the authority, and you're setting up this council. You know, if we could have stopped something like the spruce bark beetle had it come in from an importation or something from overseas, I know if the public had known that, if that had been the case, they would have been pounding on the table, certainly the timber industry. But do you think, I mean, it doesn't seem like this bill creates enough authority to actually do anything. I mean, as far as enforcement, you're going out into the field, or are you just still making recommendations, or is it up to the individual departments or agencies to do that by themselves?
I think the council is the powers to be, but really the workhorses who identify and send things up to the council would be the working group. For instance, we have a problem in the interior with a new invasive, which is birch leaf miner, which actually came out of Europe. And it came in landscape materials and went on base. Unfortunately, we didn't have enough people at the table talking to each other, and now it's getting to be widespread in Fairbanks. But what happens is we have a lot of people who are workhorses, like myself, who know there's a problem, but we're not decision makers. We're not higher level people, and our hands are totally tied. And we see the council, we see the working group is bringing these issues to the council, and the heads of these different departments being able to say, okay, we really do have a problem. We're going to give some authority here. We're going to make some suggestions on change. And that's the beauty of this, is unless we have the different departments talking to each other, we can't really work together. I'm sure some of you have been in positions within departments where you just have so much ability to work with someone else, and then you can't go any further because you don't have that authority.
Say, Michelle?
Yes?
I want to try and make sure we get the other two people who have signed up to testify in yet today. I'm hoping that you'll be able to be online with us when we bring this bill back. And again, your contact information is here, but I really respect the time that people have spent waiting to be here, and I want to make sure that they get that opportunity.
Great. Okay, and I have my email and my phone number if people want to call me after the...
And if we get time after these people are done testifying, we'll try and come back to you.
Thank you.
Lori Zamzel, are you available?
I'm here.
Go ahead, Lori, name and affiliation.
Hi. My name is Lori Zamzel, and I am co-founder of the nonprofit Citizens Against Noxious Weeds Invading the North, which is CanWin, and I'm also the coordinator for the Anchorage Cooperative Weed Management Area. I want to thank you for this opportunity to testify, and I just want to throw in 2 cents on a couple of previous points real quick. The question that Michelle was just addressing about is this council needed when there's already a working group in SNPM? And just I'm not a scientist, I'm not anybody professional, I'm a citizen who got involved in this along with my husband, but my view of that question is that the council that's allowed for in House Bill 12 would be a state-supported, a state-sanctioned, and a state-recognized council, which is something that Alaska doesn't have. The working group in SNPM is a sort of a volunteer almost group of people whose jobs have them working with invasive weeds, but they've come together as a group, but it's not really a state-recognized or state-sanctioned group, and that's exactly what Alaska needs to really have a formal program. I know in our work with invasive weeds, because Alaska didn't have a formally recognized program, we weren't eligible for federal funding, and that was huge. So with House Bill 330 and actually getting formalized, that was a huge window that opened up for us. So that would just be my thoughts on that. And if that's way off base, Jeannie or Michelle maybe can correct me on that. But that's just my layman's interpretation. And the other thing I just wanted to throw something in about was the question about would non-natives like Timothy and alfalfa be targeted? And I think it's real, something that's important to make real clear is neither the invasive weeds group nor the invasive species groups are talking about targeting non-natives. We're talking about targeting invasive noxious species. So one is not necessarily the other. There are plenty of non-natives who aren't a problem and would never even, you know, merit consideration by any groups working on invasive species. So just because something is non-native doesn't make it invasive or noxious. So having said that, I'll just go through my testimony here. What I wanted to say, again, thank you for the opportunity to testify. And last year, the first vital steps were taken to protect Alaska's economy, ecology, and environment from the devastation of noxious weeds. Troy and I had no experience with the political process, but we were very gratified by the unanimous response to House Bill 30 by both the House and the Senate, and therefore every legislator sitting in this committee today, we thank you. When Representative Johnson proposed that legislation, we vowed to dedicate our time and effort to make people like us understand the importance of developing this statewide response and why it is the fiscally responsible thing to do for their senators and representatives to do. And we've done that. We've spoken to many local, state, and national audiences about Alaska's fight with invasives. And when we've been outside at other conferences speaking, we've met experts fighting the same problem in other states that are now threatening Alaska. And without exception, we are hearing the same message that Alaska is America's last chance to do it right and not suffer the tens of millions of dollars in expense and losses that come from invasive species. But that is only going to be possible if we act quickly and aggressively while the advantage is still ours to take. If we don't spend a dollar now, we will have to spend $1,000 later. House Bill 12 is the next important step in this process. This legislation needs your vote today and as it moves forward. But in addition, Alaska and all her citizens need your continued support as the agencies and the people on the ground, like Michelle and her group, are working every day to prevent and control invasive species from impacting our great land. And that's what I have to say. And I'm happy to take questions, and I think my information is available as well.
Representative Gutenberg.
Thank you. And thank you for your interest. It sounds like you've come out of a volunteer effort that's turned into a major full-time concern for yours, like many of us around this table. But my comment to Michelle was, my concern to her was, is this council simply going to have enough muscle? You know, if it identifies a problem right in front of us, right in front of them, or somebody in the field sees something going on, are they going to be able to rifle the forces and do what needs to be done, or is that just the next step down the road where that we're going to be facing?
Yeah, I'm not sure that I would be the best person to answer that question, but what I will say is that the thing about this council is that it groups every single person, it groups all the commissioners of the agencies that do need to create the regulations, that do need to flex the muscle, so to speak. And so if all those groups are sitting around the table, along with the representatives from agriculture and commercial fishing and greenhouses and everybody else who's impacted either positively or negatively by what happens in the group, then that in itself is muscle. But it also makes recommendations and gives the power to people like Francie Havemeister and Fish and Game to say, this is why we need to make the regulation. So when it goes out for public comment, people absolutely will support it when they say, we want to, you know, make XYZ a regulation. I think it absolutely moves the process along quicker and gives it more rocket fuel to say this is why, and this is the group that says so.
Representative Johnson, what did you have in mind?
Yeah, just to follow through. Let me give you an example. Let's say somebody's harvesting pike in the interior, and they're loading it up in a tank in the back of a pickup truck, and they're taking it down to the Kenai, which it is an invasive species. Are the troopers going to be able to respond to that? Somebody's told the, you know, the Fish and Game guy standing there or something, you know, it's like, hey, I don't care, thank you, bye. You know, who has the authority to stop that action?
I'm having a real hard time hearing. It's kind of cutting in and out, but I understand the question about pike. And if I'm not mistaken, I think Fish and Game just recently passed a regulation that makes that something that's finable, but again, I'm not the right person to.
I think Representative
Pike was the wrong example.
It was. Representative Olson may have some answers.
I think I may have the answer for that. I believe several years ago that was addressed in the invasive species and concurrent sentencing of prisoner bill. I believe they kept the.
And I just want to remind that
somebody from Fish and Game, but I believe they kept that portion in when they added the 15-page prison bill into it. But I think they kept the giving the. Fish and Game the powers to do that.
And Representative Johnson had a question. Then I want to try and make sure we get in Dad and Dan Gibson, and then we do have either Kate Troll and Sue Eli from the Alaska Alliance of Conservation. I want to try and get them in the next 15 minutes.
Question so. At some point too, Mr.
Representative Edgman.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, thank you. And mine was not as much a question as it was to address the representative's concern. Whenever you get a bunch of commissioners around, they will write regulations. And when the regulations are not within the policy that we've set, they are not bashful of coming to us and saying, we need a statute so that we can write this. And typically, that's a lot of what happens, and we get it through a governor's bill. And so that's typically what happens. But if it bubbles up from the community, I think sometimes that's much better than it bubbling down from the legislature. So that's kind of what this addresses, getting those people together. And if there's a policy change that needs to be made, I'm sure they will be coming to us. They've never been bashful in the past, and I don't expect it to start now.
Representative Edgman?
Yeah, I was just thinking, isn't this kind of how the Coastal Zone Management Program started? And now it's in the DNR, but that different subject. But
we're not going there.
Mike, I did have a question maybe to the bill sponsor, and that is the composition of the council membership. I noticed that the intent of the program right above on page 2 mentions federal and state and so forth, but wouldn't there be a need to have maybe some federal presence on this council membership, or is there room already on the page 3? I just wrote down here the Coast Guard, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, maybe the part, you know, major managers in terms of marine and land and environments in Alaska, and then if I could, Mr. Chairman, my second comment would be on page 6, on line 8. It might be worth researching. I don't know if it's applicable or not, but it says Native Village or Regional Corporation, whether tribal entity ought to be in there, given the health organizations and the tribal status and so forth.
And if we could, I'd like maybe Representative Edgman to work with the sponsor, you know, on any suggestions that he has for this bill. We're not passing this out today, but,
no, but
I really want to make sure we get the citizens who've been waiting.
And I understand. I wanted to testify, Chairman, very quickly, just to have my comments out there with everybody online.
Go ahead.
Thank you.
Thank you. We'll get to that one in another day. Thank you. Thank you, Lori.
Thank you.
Dan Gibson. Dan's the project manager for the oil spill prevention response operation for the Prince William Sound Regional Citizens Advisory Council. Thanks. Dan, are you there?
Yeah, I am.
Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, thanks for allowing me to address the committee. I believe you guys already have a copy of my written testimony, so I won't go line by line. I'll just try to hit some highlights. I know meetings get long enough without repeating others. The organization I'm with has been following the issue of invasives for probably 12 to 14 years now, ever since the mid-90s, and we got interested in this issue because of the introduction of potential invasives through ballast water in tankers that offload ballast water in Port Valdez. We believe this legislation would be vital in as the first step in helping to protect our natural resources up here from the threat of these invasive organisms. Like you've heard before me, the minor amount of money that we'll spend annually on this invasives council could, save us a lot of money in the long run in lost economies, environments, and industries associated with controlling invasives. And there's been plenty of examples that, we've heard already from the lower 48 about controlling invasives like zebra mussels in the Great Lakes area. A more immediate threat to Alaska coastlines, as you've heard, is the European green crab, which is a pretty invasive critter that's moved up its way up the west coast and has caused a lot of problems. And it's not really a matter of if we get these crabs, but where and when. And, you know, there's plenty of evidence already of the economic devastation that they have caused, especially on the East Coast with the softshell clam industry. And, you know, I've seen firsthand some of the impact the green crab have had down in Ucluelet, British Columbia. And it's not pretty, the kinds of problems that they're causing in those ecosystems down there. And they're much similar environments that, you know, that we have up here in Alaska. You know, we know these crabs can survive and establish themselves in our waters. We've already been pretty active. This working group, the Invasive Species Working Group, for the last couple of years, has been instrumental in starting these partnerships with these other groups that have the resources to look at these issues. Establishing this council, you know, goes another step forward with that. You know, at this moment, Alaska's relatively free of invasive species, but contrary to popular myth, you know, we're not as isolated as we once thought we were with the amounts of air, water, and land traffic we get. Plus, this other factor of climate change is making Alaska more favorable for these introductions. So, you know, unless we take a real proactive stance on this issue, you know, we're going to be suffering some of the same problems that the lower 48 states are dealing with invasives. And, you know, formating a council to develop, you know, strategic plans, a body to coordinate resources and efforts and share information is essential to tackling this issue. So, again, the minor amount of money spent in the short term, I think, will pay dividends in the long run. So I urge the committee to get behind and support this bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Dan. And for the committee members, Tom Lawson was with the Division of Fish and Game, and he can talk to the fiscal. Now, Tom, where are you at? So there's the guy to talk to. We need to talk about the fiscal note on that. Did we have any questions for Dan? Thank you, Dan. We also have Kate Troll and Sue Eli from the Alaska Alliance Conservation. So we got time for one of you to come on up and talk today. We need to gavel out at 3 today. We left the floor at about 5 minutes to 1, and everybody had to get here, and we all got about 3 more committees yet to get in today. So
I'll be fast. Good afternoon, Chairman, Co-Chairs Newman and Johnson, and members of the Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Sue Ely, and I am here on behalf of the Alaska Conservation Alliance, which is a coalition of 40 Alaskan conservation organizations with a combined membership of over 38,000 Alaskans. And I'd like to thank you for the opportunity to speak in support of House Bill 12, establishing the Alaska Council on Invasive Species. Alaska is home to an amazing abundance of plant and animal life. Whether it's valued as charismatic Alaskan icons or the source of our continued economic and subsistence prosperity, Alaska's flora and fauna are vital to our economic well-being and Alaska's way of life. However, these resources could be threatened by the spread of invasive species. We've already seen the effects of Atlantic salmon, pike, rats. We talked about the Asian gypsy moth today, the birch leaf miner. Plants, animals, fish, and crustaceans that are introduced into an environment devoid of their natural predators and limitations can irreversibly destroy an ecosystem, and that destruction can translate directly into monetary, cultural, and lifestyle impacts. Invasive species have cost lower 48 economies billions of dollars in revenue. In order for Alaska to avoid a similar fate, it is prudent to address this issue now, and we thank the committee for taking this issue up. I believe that the 14-member council will provide the broad stakeholder cooperation and oversight needed to prevent new invasive species from taking root in Alaska and mitigate any damage from existing invasives. At risk are Alaska's biological treasures, and it is our understanding and hope that this committee would use the least amount of the least toxic management tools to address these concerns, and using pesticides only as a last resort. The Alaska Conservation Alliance would like to thank you for this opportunity to voice our support for this bill and encourage you to pass it at your next committee hearing. Thank you very much, and short.
Thank you, Sue. Any questions for Sue? We also had, there's some other people here just for members' information. We've got Louisa Castrodell from DEC. Louisa, raise your hand there. Or, I guess she's never got her online. Kristen Ryan from DEC. Gino Graziano was hired last year, I believe, thanks to a bill sponsored by Representative Johnson that created an invasive species coordinator. So we do have somebody on the ground currently looking at this within our State Department, which is a good thing. We've got lots more information here from other folks that would like to take time. Those names are in your packet. Ryan Stansel, Operating Manager, Anchorage Soil and Water Conservation District. Matthew Cronin, he's a research professional. And again, Kristen Ryan from DEC. But again, we need to get wrapped up here today. We're not going to pass this out today. So did you have a...
If I could just like say, I have towards the back of the...
Name real quick for the record.
Through the record. Chair. Through in the back of the... Towards the back of the book, you'll see a non-native invasive animals of Alaska report. This lists the invasives that are here in Alaska now, documented, 40-some species. And then it also indicates a number of species that are could be here. So if you could look through those, that'll give you some good idea of what's happening in the state right now. Thank you.
Representative Seaton, do you have something real quick?
Just very quickly, for people that are contacting my office, I just wanted to let them know that, you know, this committee has passed invasive species legislation before, and it, you know, it's not a question of whether we're concerned about those. So you could help us the best by looking at this bill and talking about the context and the process of using this bill and the council as it's set up to accomplish that goal. But we're, this whole committee, as I think Mr. Chairman will agree, is all on board about making sure that we don't have the spread of invasive species around the state. So we don't, you know, I mean, so that the public can expend their energy in the best way, letting us know how this could best be affected, not that we share the same goal. Thank you.
What I'd suggest on that, Representative Seaton, is talk to our Director of Ag, talk to our Director of Invasive Species, see what they're doing, you know, see what coordinated efforts we've already got on the ground, too. Look at how this can maybe complement that. But with that said, we will adjourn, and the time is 3 o'clock.